Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Baseball America podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer, joined today by Ben Badler to discuss the Blue Jays system. Ben, we always appreciate your insight coming on and joining us. The Blue Jays had a rough year this year. They went 67-95. That was the franchise's worst winning percentage since 1995 in the abbreviated season. So the present was not good in terms of wins and losses. However, we did see the Blue Jays bring up a lot of talented players. We saw Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette come up and make a big impact. We also saw Kevin Biggio come up and do some good things. Danny Jansen took over as their everyday catcher. A lot of other players came up and made some contributions as well. Trent Thornton in the starting rotation. When you kind of assess where the Blue Jays are now, given the young players they brought up to the big leagues this year and looking at their farm system now, how far away is this team from contention?
I would not expect anything in 2020. I would not expect contention then. They have, like you said, they have the young nucleus of a lineup there. They have Vladdy Jr., they have Bo Bichette, Gurriel, Kevin Biggio is looking like he's going to carve out a pretty solid major league career for himself. And on the pitching side, they need a lot of help. Nate Pearson might be their best starter. Right now, like immediately in 2020, I don't necessarily expect them to be up on opening day, but they're going to need a lot more help around him because they're pretty thin on the pitching side. So I think it's probably going to be another under 500 or maybe 500-ish type year in 2020. So 2021 is possible for contention, but it could, you know, if they don't make the right moves, it could be even a year beyond that.
Yeah, you mentioned making moves. Marcus Stroman was traded at the deadline to the Mets for Simeon Woods Richardson and Anthony Kay, obviously ending a very, very storied tenure in Toronto. Aaron Sanchez, who the Blue Jays thought would be a stalwart in the rotation for a long time, injuries really sidetracked him. He was traded this year as well to the Astros. And some of the young pitchers they had come up were guys that were previously highly touted or high draft picks. We saw Sean Reed Foley come up and make six starts. TJ Zoit came up and made three starts and five appearances overall. Anthony Kay did come up and make three appearances here at the end of the year. So there are young arms there, but as you mentioned, it's not exactly a slam dunk that any of these guys are going to be necessarily in the rotation in 2021, 2022, 2023. Again, Nate Pearson could be a front of the rotation guy. Maybe some of those guys fall at the back of the rotation, but they still need some meat in the middle is what it seems like, at least from the outside.
Yeah, I think Nate Pearson's really the only guy from that group with a chance to be like a frontline impact type starter. The other guys, maybe if everything goes right, back end type starter, maybe relievers, but guys that pretty much every organization has in their farm system or on their major league team. So they're going to need a lot more help, I think, on the pitching side.
We talked about end of an era. We'd be remiss without mentioning Kevin Pillar being traded to the Giants at the beginning of the year. Again, the Blue Jays, there was no expectation they would compete this year. Seeing them trade Kevin Pillar, seeing them trade Marcus Stroman, seeing them trade Aaron Sanchez, it did feel like this was kind of the last vestiges of the Blue Jays teams that were competitive and made back-to-back ALCSs in 2015 and 16. Kind of pack their bags and really kind of see the leaf turn over and the next era of Blue Jays baseball begin.
Yeah, and probably, something that probably could have been done a little bit earlier. I think it probably would have expedited the rebuild process to try to, put a little bit more talent surrounding some of these young hitters that they have coming up. But obviously, I think it was probably overdoing it in some of those cases, but, certainly the right time. It was certainly time to trade those guys at this point when they did.
Looking forward, you mentioned there's a lot of really, really talented young position players on this team. We talked about Guerrero and Bichette and Biggio all coming up this year. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. staying healthy and showing what he could do. Jansen coming up and taking over as the everyday catcher and being a Gold Glove finalist defensively, even though the bat wasn't as good as expected. Looking forward to the next wave, we hit on a little bit the pitchers. Two of the top three players in this system are pitchers. Nate Pearson, the top prospect in the system, as well as one of the top pitching prospects in baseball. And Simeon Woods Richardson, one of the players they acquired from the Mets for Marcus Stroman, checked in at number three. We mentioned the Blue Jays really, really needing starting pitching help. What kind of starters can these guys be? Again, Nate Pearson's number one in the system. Is this a true number one potential starter? Because we all know how rare those guys are.
I think he has that potential. I mean, we have to see a little bit more about the durability. I mean, the durability questions in his case are, he had like a freak injury. It's not like he had, Tommy John or anything like that. He got hit by a comebacker on his off the forearm in 2018, so he basically didn't pitch at all that season. So he had a really unusual workload this season where most of the year he's alternating between throwing five innings, two innings, five innings, two innings. So it was a pretty unusual workload. Ended up throwing about 100 innings total this year, but he seems like a guy who should be able to hold innings, and if he does that, it's the stuff is front of the rotation kind of stuff. Close to a mid 100s fastball at the very, very high end. He sits upper 90s. A lot of guys will sit low to mid 90s who can, even guys who can touch triple digits, but he's pretty consistent even when he's going deeper into games is pretty much sitting in the upper 90s. It's late, it's explosive life to go with the velocity. The slider took a pretty big step forward over the last year plus. 60 to 70 grades on that pitch, and I don't think he's really needed to use the changeup a lot, even at the upper levels yet. But I think he's got feel for that pitch too, to, you know, to maybe be a 50, 55 type weapon for him. So, athletic, it's a pretty good delivery. It's pretty efficient for such a big guy, being 6'6". You look at all the stuff, the track record of missing bats, he throws strikes. I mean, all I really want to see at this point is him being able to, you know, handle that full season starter workload. And if he can do that, I think he has all the attributes that you see in a number one or number two type of starter.
Yeah, you mentioned the durability, and that was the biggest question with him. I think one of the most encouraging signs was at the end of the year, his final couple starts at AA New Hampshire and the three starts he made at AAA Buffalo. He went at least five innings in his final eight starts. The Blue Jays kind of let him loose at the end of the year. We saw a couple six-inning starts in there. We saw a seven shutout inning start in there in his AAA debut. So it did seem like he was building up, and you're right, for so much of the year it was those five innings, two innings, and you never really know until someone does it, how are they going to respond to having to go, you know, five, six, seven, sometimes even pitch into the eighth inning every 5 days. But he showed a little bit of sign there at the end of the year that he was able to do it again. Small sample, we're talking about a month of doing it, but just the fact he hadn't done it before, I feel like you feel a little more confident now about it than you did maybe at the All-Star break.
Yeah, it was good to see the reins taken off a little bit there at the end, so we could start to see how his stuff plays deeper into games when he's doing it on a weekly basis. So it's one of those things where I think he can do it. It's just, you know, we've never seen him do it before, and sometimes guys, you know, when they do get to that 125, 130 plus inning mark, sometimes, you know, you start to see guys have issues there. I don't see any reason why that would be the case with him. It's just he's either the best pitching prospect in baseball or at least one of the top two or three pitching prospects in the game. So it's almost nitpicking a little bit. It's a really high upside. It's just it's kind of like the last step that you want to see from him. And it's something you're probably not going to see until he actually gets the big lead, which will probably be very, very early in 2020.
And then Simeon Wood Richardson, who is the number three prospect in the system, what did he show the Blue Jays quickly? Because, again, he only came over at the trade deadline, a little over a month left in the minor league season, but he already made his way up to high class A. He was 18. There were good reports on him when he was still with the Mets pitching at low class A Columbia. What did the Blue Jays see in him that, A, made them want to acquire him in the first place, and, B, that they felt that he's already one of the top three prospects in their system?
What I like about Woods Richardson, I mean, it's a combination of youth. I mean, he played all season at 18 years old, and he just turned 19 in September after the season. So he's super young for being a 2018 draft pick. You could probably put him into the 2019 draft almost. Those are almost those guys are almost more his peers. And for him to be that young but still have a combination of stuff and polish, I mean, you would not think he was 18 years old. The feel for pitching is way, way beyond his years. He's he's strong, he's athletic, he throws a ton of strikes. You can see the strikeout to walk numbers on him. You know, even before the trade, the numbers were better after the trade. Moving up a level to the Florida State League, but he's, you know, consistently had very strong strikeout to walk numbers because his feel for pitching is so good, and his stuff is good too. It's not Nate Pearson good, but it's, you know, low to mid 90s fastball. I think he's relatively filled out, but just, you know, with his age and some of the things in there, I think there might be a little more velocity still to squeeze out of there. But, you know, even if not, it's already, you know, low to mid 90s fastball. It's one of those, you know, high spin, hoppy fastballs, gets good extension too. So the fastball plays up even more than the radar gun suggests, and he's able to get swing and miss there. You know, slider, curveball. I think the changeup's still a little bit behind right now, but I think that's got a chance to be an average pitch. So it's a guy who's got a chance for you know, average to plus pitches across the board, who throws a ton of strikes, and you know, and misses bats. So you know, this is the kind of guy where I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, by the time he's 20, 21, he's going to be up in Toronto already at that point.
We talked about the Blue Jays' need for front to mid rotation starters. Is there number two starter upside here?
I think if everything goes right, yeah. You know, it's sometimes, you know, even at that age when they're still 18, it's almost tough to say like what is the true ceiling or upside for a pitcher. But I think it's certainly, you can see without having to project a ton, a path to him becoming a mid rotation starter. And I think there's probably enough upside in there for him to potentially develop into a number two if everything goes right for him.
The Blue Jays have a number of pitchers in their system. We talked about some of the guys they've used high draft picks on in recent years. They went to the pitching well again with their first-round pick this year in Alek Manoah. You have him penciled into the projected 2023 lineup as the Blue Jays' number three starter by then. Again, another guy who the Blue Jays really do need to kind of click and have everything come together if they really are going to be contenders within the next 3, 4, 5 years. What is it about Manoah that gives you and the Blue Jays faith that he could settle in and become that number three starter they're going to need?
Yeah, and 250 might be
generous.
Might be on the lighter end too. I mean, the Blue Jays have been taking, you know, whether it's Pearson or Manoah or Adam Kloppenstein, Kendall Williams, they've been, you know, on the other end, I guess you've got Eric Pardino, but for the most part, especially out of the draft, they've been piling up these extra large, beefy right-handed pitchers into the system. And yeah, I mean, Manoah is probably the biggest of that group physically. It's
6'6", 260 is the official measurement.
Yeah, I mean, it's 6'6", maybe, you know, tickling 6'7", and yeah, the weight is either way, he's a big guy. It's big stuff. I mean, it's, you know, fastball sitting usually about 93 to 95 96. He can run it up to 98 when he needs to. The slider when it's on is another pitch for him that's a plus pitch. I think he's shown some feel for the changeup, and he's probably, I think, a better athlete than maybe he gets credit for. I think that's, you know, we see these really big guys sometimes, if they're not great athletes, it takes them either a while or they never end up figuring it out, being able to sync everything up in their delivery. But when you can see he went out, and you know, not a big sample, and it's just the Northwest League, but he went out and he threw strikes, and I think his, you know, he has a delivery that's conducive to him being able to a starter. His control has improved over the past couple of years. So I think those are kind of arrows that are pointing in the right direction for him. You know, further away, even though he's older than it was Richardson, but you know, just because he was just drafted this year, but somebody who I think, you know, probably could, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he ended up finishing the season in Double A. I mean, that would be aggressive for him, but a guy who's got a big power arm, and another guy, I think, yeah, an important guy for them, who has a chance to be a mid rotation type of arm for them.
We saw Nate Pearson climb into the top 10 prospects in all of baseball. Jordan Groshans was moving his way into the top 50, missed most of the year with a leg injury. Simeon Woods Richardson, as someone that people have talked about as being a potential top 100 prospect, whether it's this year or in future years. It seems like the top three, that's really the clear-cut top tier. And then we move into that international group with Alek Manoah in there. Is that an accurate assessment? Those top three, there's kind of a clear separation, and then the rest, it's a little more mixed? Or was it even clear, you know, who's four, five, six, and seven?
I think it was definitely for me, it was a clear top two. You know, Pearson, I think, was an obvious number one. Jordan Groshans, it was so disappointing that he barely got to play beyond, you know, April and maybe I think a little bit of May even. But he missed, you know, almost all year, but everything when he was healthy from, you know, going back to last year in the Gulf Coast League to early this year and in the Midwest League, which is not an easy place to hit, you know, especially for a high school kid from Texas going into that cold weather environment. I mean, he went in and just lit it up immediately, just got such good reviews from scouts. So I'm just a huge fan of Jordan Groshans. And then, you know, obviously I went with Richardson at three, but, you know, you could probably, I mean, I have the most polarizing guy probably in the organization is Alejandro Kirk. You know, we went with Kirk at four. You know, you can find people who would have him even higher, I think, up on the Blue Jays list, and you can find people who would have him significantly lower too. He's just such an unusual guy. You know, we talked about you know, big beefy players in the Blue Jays system on the pitching side, and Kirk is he doesn't have the, you know, certainly the height. He's about 5'9", but he probably has the weight of some of those other pitchers we were talking about. So it's you know, it's not a good body. He needs to get into better shape. But I think there's some people who just can't get beyond the body and write him off because of that. But I think he's a really, really good hitter. He has a lot of tools and a lot of attributes that a lot of really good hitters have. It's a really tight, short swing. He's got good bat speed. He tracks the ball really well, you know, which helps him make later decisions on, you know, when to swing to, you know, where you can let the ball travel deeper into the hitting zone, and his bat is in the hitting zone for a long time. And he has really, really good hand-eye coordination and just a good eye for the strike zone in general. A guy who, you know, walked more than he struck out and has been pushed pretty aggressively through the system too, and everywhere he's gone, he's consistently hit well and gotten on base at a high rate. So, you know, I think that's probably, yeah, the point in the system where you could probably go, you know, different ways depending on what it is that you're looking for in a player at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned Kirk being divisive, but obviously a lot of faith did exist among the scouting community to place him so high up, especially in his ability to hit. Manoah, we've talked about being a first rounder with mid rotation potential. Anthony Kay and Adam Klopfenstein are two pitchers that kind of round out the top 10, or I shouldn't say kind of, they are two pitchers who round out the top 10. You also have them projected, or at least you have Anthony Kay projected in the future rotation, with Klopfenstein potentially a guy that can force his way in there at some point. Was this the clear top 10, or were there some guys beyond this group that you felt have an argument and came close?
Yeah, I think, yeah, you know, with the, you know, in Kay's case, I think he's not like a safe back end starter, but like there's not a lot of, you know, room for him to go to get to that. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's probably going to, you know, pitch right away in the back of their rotation, you know, in 2020. You know, he's going to need a little bit more to stick in that role in terms of development, but, you know, a lot lower risk than, you know, somebody like Klopfenstein or, you know, somebody who, you know, who dropped out of the top 10 this year, like Eric Pardino, where you know, in Pardinho's case, there's a lot to like about him from, you know, from what you saw in 2018, but from, you know, 2019, he was hurt, and then he came back this year, and when he did come back, the stuff was down, so, you know, maybe he just, you know, he just was never 100% all year, and the stuff comes back in 2020, and he moves way up the list again, but definitely some more red flags there with the with Pardinho. But yeah, I mean, you know, Clough and Steen, it's I think it's certainly further away, and you're hoping that there's, you know, more projection that ends up coming through on his stuff, because it's, you know, it's solid stuff, but it's not like there's a wipeout pitch in there right now. He does show good feel for spinning the ball, for spinning his breaking pitches. You hope that the stuff ticks up a little bit more in his case, but there's, you know, there's some other interesting guys kind of in that next tier of guys. I mean, Otto Lopez is a really interesting guy to me, a guy who won the batting title in the Midwest League, and I think there's, you know, not a ton of tools with him. I don't think he's gonna like wow anybody if you see him in like a workout, but I think there's some more untapped power potential in there if, and it's kind of a big if, he's able to make an adjustment with his kind of with his swing, but almost more the approach. I mean, his approach is really just geared to trying to, you know, put the ball in play, whereas if I think he, if he kind of made an adjustment with his approach to look to drive more pitches for damage and really go for more extra base hit type power, even if it led to a little bit more swing and miss, because, you know, his hand-eye coordination is so good, I don't think he's ever going to be a high strikeout guy, but I think there's some more power upside there. You know, you've got guys like Griffin Conine, who enormous. I mean, it's probably 70 raw power. That the guy missed 50 games with a suspension and still led the Midwest League in home runs. I think he led the league in slugging by like 100 points or so. I mean, it's pretty big power, but it's also pretty big strikeouts too. You know, you've got some pretty interesting you know, guys they added to the system this year through the draft and through international free agency. Kendall Williams, a right-handed pitcher, a couple shortstops, and Steven Machado out of Venezuela, Raquelvin Castro from the Dominican Republic, and Leonardo Jimenez, who's already in the system too, a signing out of Panama, who's in the Appalachian League this year, where you're, you know, a lot of good action, but you're just kind of waiting slash hoping maybe on strength coming around with him. So there's I mean, you know, right in that kind of, you know, 9 to, I don't know, 15, 17, 18 almost range, there's a pretty interesting mix of guys there, which I think speaks well to the depth of the system for an organization that just graduated Vladdy Jr. and Bo Bichette. I mean, two top 10 prospects, and Biggio and Gurriel. So, you know, for an organization that just graduated some pretty serious dudes, there's still some pretty good depth in the organization too.
I think it's important to note too, the Blue Jays, we're not talking about a small market team here. Toronto's a major market. We saw only a few years ago, they were drawing 3 million plus fans. This year, attendance dropped to its lowest mark since 2010. And we've talked about it was the worst record since 1995. So while there is the promise of better days ahead, even though Blue Jays fans have been accustomed to long playoff droughts, they famously did not make the postseason between their 1993 World Series and their 2015 American League Championship Series appearance. It does feel like this is not a market that's going to sit back and wait and say, oh, another 10 years of, you know, mediocrity is going to be acceptable. I mean, this is a franchise we've seen. When they're competitive, the fans show out with the best in baseball and are among the loudest and most excited in baseball. Given we've already established, unless the Blue Jays decide to make a number of win-now moves this offseason, they're not going to compete in 2020. Odds are they're not going to compete in 2021 either, just because we see pitchers' development takes a while even after they get to the majors. It does feel like 2022 is the earliest any sort of contention is realistic. Do you see a way for the Blue Jays to accelerate that timeline at all without necessarily harming the long-term viability of the club? Or is this something that if they really do want to contend for the long term, they're going to have to wait it out for another, you know, 2, 3, maybe even 4 years?
And I think 2021 is possible for them to cut back to contention. I mean, you have...
Without any major free agent signings? That seems optimistic given the state of the current rotation.
Without, you know, if they're not going to spend money to sign free agents, I think that would be difficult. Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to have to sign, especially on the pitching side. Some more players to put around Nate Pearson. And look, I mean, Nate Pearson is not a lock either. I mean, you know, nobody really is, especially on the pitching side. But they're going to have to sign major league free agents, I think, especially in that starting rotation. And, you know, look, they also have players who, come 2021 or going into the 2021 season where, if they wanted to trade players, they certainly have the prospects to do it. They're, you know, picking, I believe it's 5th overall in the draft this year. I mean, they should have even more prospects that they're going to add to the farm system before then. So, I think if they supplement that core lineup that they have and build around Vladdy and Bo, and then you've got Biggio and Gurriel as well, and I think probably there's some more. I think there's some more upside there too with Jansen than at least offensively than what he showed in 2019. I think there's some core pieces of the lineup there. You might have a couple of perennial all-stars in Vlad and Bo, so you have the pieces to build around. But yeah, it's going to come down to making the right, whether it's free agent signings or trading the right, or making the right trades. There's certainly the potential for them to contend in 2021, but like you were saying, they're going to have to make the right moves for them just to get back there. It's not like the AL East is full of soft spots other than Baltimore, so it's not easy.
It will be a difficult road back to contention, and we'll see if the Blue Jays can pull it off with some of the prospects coming up the system and whatever free agent signings they make. GM Ross Adkins has already said this offseason he intends to be aggressive on the pitching front, so we'll see how that turns out. Ben, thank you so much for joining us to break down the Blue Jays farm system. We appreciate your insight as always.
No, it was good talking to you, Kyle.
Once again, that was Ben Badler here to break down the Blue Jays system for us. We always appreciate his insight. We actually have a very special treat for all you listeners out there. We have an interview with Nate Pearson, the Toronto Blue Jays number one prospect. Nate's been through a really interesting rise to top prospect status. He was a reliever as a freshman at Florida International, transferred to junior college, turned himself into a starter and one of the top prospects in the nation, was drafted, missed all of 2018 after a freak injury, came back in 2019, rose all the way to AAA. So it's been kind of a whirlwind rise for Nate, and he was kind enough to join us. Nate, first and foremost, when you see that you are named the number one prospect in the Toronto Blue Jays system by Baseball America, what does that feel like, and how much attention do you pay to that?
I don't really pay that much attention to it. I just try to control what I can control and just continue to have some success in the minor leagues and eventually reach my goal of being a big leaguer.
At the same time, I know a lot of other people definitely pay attention. When that something like that happens, do you get a lot of texts, a lot of phone calls? What's that like?
Yeah, a few people reach out to me whenever you guys bring out a new list, or if I rise up in the rankings, whatever. You know, my dad's always following; he's really big into it. But he always texts me and say, "Hey, congrats, you're moving up." Or my buddies from back home, well, they're always following it. So I do get a few friends and family reach out to me.
You began your college career at Florida International, mostly pitched out of the bullpen, and then made your way over to Junior College of Central Florida. You were in the bullpen in the fall, eventually moved into a starting role that spring, made yourself into a first-round pick. You were selected 28th overall by the Blue Jays after that season at JC of Central Florida. What changed for you there, and how did you grow as a pitcher that became a first-round pick?
I just learned how to get deeper into games because until then, since high school, I haven't really been deep into games until my junior college season. So just getting into the seventh and eighth inning, knowing what that feels like, and just learning how to pitch better, you know, not relying just on the fastball, being able to throw my off-speed pitches, learning how to sequence my pitches better. And obviously I wasn't facing the best college competition like I would be at like an SEC school, but you know, I was able to still work on what I went to junior college for, and that's just to be a better pitcher and see how successful I can be in the draft.
One of the biggest strides you made was with your command. You've always been a big guy who threw hard. You mentioned pitching deeper into games, really learning how to pitch. But your command specifically was cited by scouts as what helped you vault into first-round consideration as opposed to being just another guy who threw hard. How did that grow throughout that year, and where would you say you started from to where you ended at?
I'd like to say ever since high school, I've always been able to fill up the strike zone with not necessarily accuracy, but with command. Like, I've never been like crazy wild and walking a bunch of people. I'll lose feel here and there, but like for the most part, I'll be around the zone and be able to attack hitters. And I think that definitely took a step forward when I became a starter my sophomore year. And I really just learned that I have to be able to go deep into games, and in order to do that, I have to limit my pitch count. And so I'm able to do that. So I learned just try to get batters out three pitches or less, avoid walks, and just fill up the strike zone, really.
Throughout that spring, your name kept coming up a little bit, coming up a little bit. When did you get a sense that you had a chance to go in the first round?
Definitely after my bullpen session in front of all those scouts in Lakeland, where that kind of just solidified me at the end of the first round. So I knew I had a shot of being a first rounder after that.
And what was the process like with the Blue Jays? Did they have a lot of contact with you before the draft? Was it mostly after the draft? How did that process unfold with them?
Well, I got to know the Blue Jays area scout at the time. He was the first scout to ever talk to me in high school, Matt Bischoff. He was the first professional scout I talked to in high school, and he loved me then. And obviously, I didn't get drafted out of high school, but he followed me through my 2 years in college, and I ended up back in his area at College Central Florida. So he just picked up where he left off, and he came to the house and we sat down. He said how much they were really interested in me. Obviously didn't say first round contention at the time, but I just knew the Jays liked me. And then towards the draft came around, they had me out at the complex here in Dunedin and showed me around and everything. So I kind of got the feeling that they really liked me and what they saw. So it was, I knew it was close to home, so I was hoping that would be the case, and ended up happening in June, and I'm very thankful and blessed.
Throughout your time in college, you sat 93-94, touched 97-98, obviously threw plenty hard, but once you went out to Vancouver after that draft year, almost immediately there was a little bit of a velo bump. Some scouts were starting to see some mid to upper 90s, touching 101 in short bursts. You carried it through into the next season, even though it was limited by injury. You showed it in the fall league. And really into this season, you've really maintained it. What do you kind of credit the velocity bump to over the last couple of years?
Just my training regimen and my nutrition. I cleaned up my diet. Definitely dropped some weight when I was carrying in junior college. And when I got into pro ball, I learned that the seasons are long and I need to get to more athletic build that I am right now. And also the driveline stuff I do helps with my arm care and just maintaining my healthy arm. So that's definitely a key factor too.
You mentioned getting your body in shape. What did you weigh at your heaviest and where are you at now?
At my heaviest, I think right when I got to Vancouver, I was about 270. And now I'm about 250. So I lost about 20 pounds. And I think 250 is around the mark where I need to stay at. That's where I was at most of this this season, and I'm even trimming some of the fat still, just getting to more athletic body and just being lighter and quicker on the mound.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people think if you move from the bullpen to the rotation, your velocity is going to tick down. They assume you go rotation to bullpen, it ticks up. And that is normally what happens. You kind of went the opposite way. You were in the bullpen, moved to a starter, and you threw harder. How did that kind of transpire?
I'd say I've always had a starter's mindset. Even when I was coming out of the pen, I've always, even though I knew I was only going one or two innings, I kind of envisioned myself going at least six. And that kind of stemmed in high school. Ever since, even in high school, when I'd get to the third or fourth, that's my feel would start getting stronger. And I'd usually top out my highest velo usually in the later innings. And that was the case this year where I'd warm up. I'd probably sit around like 96, 97. And then the fifth and sixth inning came around, or fourth, fifth, and sixth. And I'd be hitting into the 101, 102 range. And so that's just how I've been all my whole career, really. It's just really a mindset that I finished strong, and you know, because you're starting to face hitters third time through the lineup, and when they see that I'm just getting more powerful, you know, it kind of warns them, and you know, they get a little bit more they think they have me figured out, but then I get more stronger, and it's a little harder for them.
Yeah, a lot of times people talk about getting stronger, staying strong late in games, and it's kind of a goal a lot of people strive for, but they're not always able to achieve. It seems like you're one of the few guys who's able to actually do it. What do you kind of credit that to?
Yeah, I just credit to my work ethic and my stuff I do off the mound, you know, with my training and my nutrition. You know, that's the whole mindset when I'm training this off season. Like when I'm working out, I'm envisioning during this season, the seventh inning, when I got bases loaded and I got two outs and a 3-2 count, like I'm gonna give my best pitch. Now, you know, that's what I train for. It's what I live for, essentially. You know, just for those moments, and just make sure I'm prepared and visualizing that moment.
During the 2018 season, you had a back injury that prevented you from pitching the first month of the season. You only got in for an inning and two-thirds before taking a line drive off your right forearm, ended your season. How difficult was that for you, knowing it should have been your first full season and you got to throw an inning and two-thirds?
You know, it was a tough pill to swallow because, you know, especially looking at this year, how quickly I was able to move, you know, makes you think that if I was healthy all last year, where I'd be at right now. But you know, God has a plan, and I just trust in that. And I had a really good support system when it happened, and you know, I was able to just deal with it and just show up every day and just keep working hard and just envision for a healthy 2019. And that's exactly what happened.
You came back for the Arizona Fall League, famously touched 104 there. Had, you know, some pretty dominant radar gun readings. I remember actually covering one of your games there, one of your last ones. And while you'd been lining up the radar gun, you and I had talked about, you know, getting command of your secondary stuff, getting your feel back. That was still coming along at the time your ERA in the Fall League was over 10. When did you feel like that stuff really started to click back for you and you were back to being kind of in peak form?
Definitely after the Fall Starts game out there. I kind of envision, looking back on it now, like the first three starts I had in the Fall League, that was basically like my spring training, because I came as soon as I was healthy and on the mound. I got a couple instructs starts, and then I just shipped right out there. So looking back on it now, like I didn't really have that much time to face hitters. I mean, I was fully healthy and ready to go. Like I was arm-wise, I was ready to go. But, you know, as the season goes on, you learn a little bit more, and you get more experience, you get more comfortable with pitches. That's why we have spring training, you know. So that was basically my spring training, the first three starts there. And after the Fall Starts game is when I really hit my stride. And it was pretty evident my last few starts there. But, yeah, I definitely got more comfortable, more confident in my off-speed pitches, and it definitely helped out.
You come out this year, full year ahead of you. You start at High Class A Dunedin, six starts. They bump you up to Double A. Spent a lot of the season there, and then in August they bump you up to AAA. Spent time at three levels, and now you're on the verge of the majors. What was this season like for you, and what do you attribute it to?
I definitely attribute it to my work ethic and showing up to the field every day and with the mindset of working on something. You know, I don't take a day off. You know, I'm making sure I'm getting better each day, and it really attribute to the pitching coaches I had along the way. Each pitching coach taught me something that I never even thought of before, being in Dunedin, and then Double A with Coach Vince Horstman helped me out with my curveball, and then got up to Triple A and helped, and Doug Mathis helped me with my my slider and curveball command, and also with my changeup. So I was only there for three starts, but I was kind of got me pumped up for next year and in spring training when I get to work with all those guys again.
Did you come into the year thinking Triple A was a possibility, or was Double A the goal?
I mean, it was before the season even started. I knew I was probably going to start in high just because, but I knew my goal was to end up in Triple A, and I just wanted to get as much momentum as I can. I had a lot coming from the fall league. I just wanted to carry that over into the season, and that's what I was able to do, and I was able to complete my goal of making it to Triple A.
So when they informed you that they were bumping you up there for those final couple weeks of the season, knowing that meant you had achieved your goal, what was that emotion like for you, especially after missing all of last year?
I mean, it was an awesome feeling, because I remember talking with my parents coming into this past year, and I was like, yeah, I want to end up in Triple A this year. Not like technically make up for lost time last year, but, you know, just to be healthy all year. And if I'm at my healthy self, I know I can put up some really good numbers and really just full head of steam, just keep going through the minors.
Throughout the first part of the year, the Blue Jays were kind of staggering you with a five-inning start followed by a two-inning start, 5-2, 5-2, 5-2, just to help you build up innings after missing so much time last year. Later in the year, they kind of turned you loose, and you started putting together some consecutive starts, 5 2/3, 6 innings, 5, 6, 5 2/3, 7. How was it liberating when they turned you loose? Because I would imagine it would be frustrating sometimes. You go out through two dominant innings, then they yank you.
Yeah, no, it was definitely something I had to struggle, not really struggle to deal with, but just knowing going into my two-inning start that I'd be feeling really good after the second, you know, like just coming off K in the side or whatever, have two really strong innings and, like, pull me. So it was kind of frustrating being the competitor I am, you know, wanting to go deep into games. But when they finally let me loose, it was just like I was in JUCO again. I was able to go deep into games, and it was an awesome feeling reaching to the seventh for the first time I broke through in AAA.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know, throughout AA, again, you were able to get, you know, 5 2/3, 6 innings. But that first AAA start at Rochester on August 20th, 7 innings, 3 hits, no runs, no walks, 3 punch outs. To have that success in your first start at the level, what was that like? And were you extra amped up for it?
Yeah, I'd definitely say I was extra amped up for it, because it was also my birthday, too. So I got called up, and I was able to start my birthday. And I had a bunch of family watching, and it was just a whirlwind of a night going through each inning and just trying to compete and get stronger throughout the outing, and just know that I'm one step away from the big leagues, and I'm able to put up these kind of numbers in my first start in AAA. It's just kind of my confidence just never wavered.
To be your first birthday start, would you say that, I should say, for that to be your birthday start, first time you go 7 innings as a professional, would you characterize that as your best pro outing to date for you?
Yeah, I definitely say for considering how long of an outing it was, being my longest of my career, I wouldn't say it was my most dominant one, but it was definitely my best overall start of my career.
I guess I should say, do you consider it the highlight of your career to date?
Yeah, I consider it being in my first start AAA. It was pretty special.
The Blue Jays, we talked about staggering your innings. You still finished with over 100 this year, finished with 101.2 after last year throwing 20 and a third in the Fall League and inning in a third in Dunedin. So still a bump of about 80 innings last year to this year. You mentioned the grind of a long season, really the first time having to pitch through it. Clearly you stayed strong to the end. Just how did you feel, and how, what was it like managing that?
Oh, man, I felt great there in, at the end of August. You know, I was ready to keep going, and I was hoping we would make the playoffs there in Buffalo, but unfortunately we came short. So I was looking forward to those couple extra postseason starts just to add to my innings total, just to get that up there, because that was the main goal, man. I just wanted to get my innings up as high as I could, so I knew I wouldn't have to necessarily deal with the innings limit this year coming up. But, yeah, it was great to have that last season.
as your stock kind of rose, you started rising higher and higher levels. People started talking about you more and more. Did you notice any changes? Were more interview requests, more autograph hounds? Did you notice some things changing about how people were approaching you?
No, not really. I try not to think too much into it. You know, there's we have a lot of good guys in our organization on each team, so we have a lot of people wanting our autographs, you know. So we had a lot of high-profile guys that I was able to play with, so I never felt like I was sneaking out by any sorts, which is a good thing.
It's been 2 years since you were drafted. How would you say you've changed or grown as a pitcher the most in those 2 years since joining the Blue Jays organization?
I'd say that I've grown as a pitcher in the sense of having more than just one elite pitch. Like when I got drafted, I was relying on my fastball heavy because that was my best pitch, and my secondaries were kind of fringy. But now I got at least three solid off-speed pitches, and my slider and changeup, my curveball's coming along. This next year is going to be I'm really looking forward to it because I know I'm just going to keep getting better like I have been the past 3 years, I should say. And just keep that momentum going forward.
Yeah, with your slider and changeup taking steps forward, do you see it as more of a, you know, testament to just throwing them more and growing more confident? Did you have to do some work to change your grip, do some things to change the pitch characteristics?
It's definitely throwing them a lot helps you develop them, but also find out that good grip that works best for you is what I was working with this year. And in spring training, I really found some grips that I really like, and I just rolled with them this year. And didn't really want to change it up because I was having success with it.
Yes. What change? What grips did you go to?
I switched my change of grip up. I was in a traditional four seam. But I switched up kind of like I don't know, what, like a Fulcrum changeup where it comes off the middle of my two fingers. They're kind of spread out. It's easier to show than to say, but I definitely killed spin on it, and I was able to create more depth and a lot more swing and misses.
Seeing that, you know, once it plays, obviously you're doing grip work, you're throwing bullpen sessions, but to go out and see it play in games was a little bit like a, whoa, all right.
Yeah, no, it was definitely cool. It started high, my changeup was really good, and obviously my slider's been pretty good. They both get swing and misses, but it felt like when I was high in double A, it was a great weapon for me to have in my changeup, especially against lefties.
And obviously, you know, developing those pitches helped you continue to vault up the minors, and now you find yourself on the cusp of the majors. Nate, when you kind of look back at the journey you've been on, going from Florida International, you know, a mid-major in the bullpen, to junior college, becoming a first-round pick, going through the injury, and now you look up and find yourself one of the top starting pitching prospects in all of baseball, is it surreal? I mean, how do you kind of characterize, you know, everything you've been through these last 4 or 5 years?
You know, it's just cool to see that all my hard work is beginning to pay off. You know, it's I may get injured or I may get some setbacks, but it's never gonna waver my work ethic and my drive to be the best. And I think that's just a tribute to the success I've had.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to seeing your continued success, and hopefully see you in the majors next year. Nate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, that was Nate Pearson of the Toronto Blue Jays, one of the top-ranked pitching prospects in baseball, and really an incredible rise to watch the last few years. The world at large got to see him in the Futures game this past summer and the Fall Stars game last fall, and saw his ability to run it up over 100 miles an hour and really dominate opponents. I know Toronto Blue Jays fans are certainly excited to see him, and we in the wider baseball world are certainly looking forward to seeing what he can do in the coming years against big league hitters. This has been another edition of the Baseball America podcast. Go ahead and give us a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or whatever platform you're listening on. We'd love to hear from you, and we look forward to bringing you more podcasts to come. We have a top 10 team podcast continuing to roll out throughout the winter, and you can be sure we'll be discussing all the upcoming offseason moves in store. Once again, for Nate Pearson, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.